On a Wednesday, May 28th, to be exact, this is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. I appreciate that you were exact. It's not May 27th. It's not May 29th. It's May 28th, folks. And today on the show, we're going to talk about President Trump's budget bill.
Big, beautiful.
Do I need to say more about it? That's the topic today. We're going to talk about it. And we have a couple of guests. Connor Lamb used to be in Congress himself. Guy Shiraki, senior fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation. And of course, we want to hear from you, as always. What do you think about President Trump's budget bill? What do you like or dislike about it? Of course, we'll dive into the details later this hour. But again, that's the question for you. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're on YouTube, hello, drop a comment in the chat.
One thing that people do remember is the name of this bill. One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Yeah. You can't forget it.
I mean, if you say anything positive or negative about Donald Trump, it inspires a lot of reaction. I have to say it's pretty good.
The name.
Branding.
Oh, my goodness. Everybody knows it. Like, you know exactly
what he's
talking
about. I don't know why
people
don't copy that aspect of his shtick. Like, just very simple, straightforward names. Sometimes the names are misleading, but in terms of just pure marketing, it's smart to call it a big, beautiful bill. And of course, everyone just repeats it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's literally what it's called.
That's actually the name.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So that's a story for a different day. We'll talk about
absolutely.
That another time.
So we have our trio of local news stories.
Trico, go.
So you can expect longer commutes if SEPTA is forced to implement the deep service cuts that would result from the pending financial shortfall. And the Philadelphia Inquirer did a piece today that dives into the impact of the potential cuts. The Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission estimates that cuts to service will put an additional 275,000 cars on the road every day, forcing drivers to spend an additional 70,000 hours in Philly's morning traffic.
How many hours?
70,000.
70,000?
Yes, hours.
That's
to get
too many hours.
That's a lot of hours.
I don't like that.
The Inquirer did a whole setup on their website that allows
data visualization.
Yeah, and it's really cool. And
it was really cool.
And it allows you to sort of check out different commutes and to imagine the impact. One example they use is the commute from Bensalem to Center City because the Trenton line would be cut and folks would be forced to drive. That commute would go from 35 minutes on an average morning with no delays to 39 minutes. Now, when you think about it, it doesn't seem like it's much longer, but when you add it up, that's an additional 17 hours in the car over the course of a year.
So, I don't like that.
So many different examples.
Too many hours again.
Yeah, but it will have a ripple effect on everyone, sure. Not just the people who would have been catching SEPTA. It will impact everybody who's in the car
but
in the mornings.
But here's who it won't have a ripple effect on.
Okay.
A Republican legislator in Indiana County.
Facts.
Or Cambria County.
Mm-hmm.
Or Cumberland County.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could argue down the line it would because of the economic impact on this region and the taxes that we contribute to state coffers. But that's a third order impact. And this is the problem with the funding system. We talked about it. The way the SEPTA funding system is set up, it is set up to rely on state funding and to minimize the amount of local funding.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have moments like this, it's very easy to go to local legislators and say, stop this from happening. Look at the impact it would have on your constituents. The problem is, those legislators are already on your side, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people that whose constituents would be impacted by it. And so when I see this and I think about the potential to convince people with data like this, the brick wall I hit is the SEPTA funding system and the fact that the people who feel the pain are not the ones in control of the budget conversation.
At least
Josh Shapiro at least is a Southeast Pennsylvania guy, so at least you have a governor, but sometimes you don't even have that.
Yeah.
You've got a governor from Western PA or something like that.
But they need to figure this out. I feel like we've been talking about this. We've only had the show for a couple of years, but this issue continuously comes up, and I think I'm hopeful that this is the year they finally figure out a funding solution.
See, but I think it's not, well, look, that would help, right? To have a dedicated stream of funding from the state to increase the amount that SEPTA gets. I think the problem, the way I view it, and I'm curious what other people think, is it's not about how much money the state gives or doesn't give. It's that SEPTA is disproportionately reliant on money from the state.
That's why it period. Needs its own funding.
And when you look at other regional transit authorities, they're more tilted toward local taxes and local funding. And that's just not the way it works here. It wasn't set up that
way. Look,
that
toll on the Schuylkill.
That's right. Congestion
Remember
pricing,
that congestive?
Baby.
We need to talk about that. We need to do a show on that. Anyway, Absolutely. Next story.
Next story. So this is a story that tracks back to something that happened last week. So last week, a jury convicted Philadelphia police officer Mark Dial of voluntary manslaughter in the killing of Eddie Irizarry during a traffic stop in Kensington. We've been talking about that case for a long time. They acquitted Dial of third-degree murder in that case. So how did the jury come to this decision? Well, if you want to know, you absolutely need to read this piece in The Inquirer by Ellie Rushing. She interviewed the foreman of the jury. So just one member of the jury, but a very important member. And that foreman walked Ellie Rushing through how the jury came to that decision. And there are tons of interesting insights. Ultimately, what the jury said is that they felt Dial's testimony was inconsistent. Dial said he thought that the knife that Irizarry had on him was a gun. That's what the officer said. But then the officer also said that he couldn't see much because of the glare from the rolled up car windows in the car that Irizarry was in. Also very interesting, the jury took issue with the way that Dial's attorneys, the defense attorneys, described the neighborhoods where Dial patrolled.
War zones,
They referred to them as war zones. And what the foreman told The Inquirer is that these are the neighborhoods we live and work in, and we did not appreciate them being referred to as war zones, and we didn't appreciate that as a justification for shooting a man.
Yeah.
Because that could have been me, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought that was fascinating as well.
Well, I thought it was interesting that three jurors initially wanted to acquit Dial at the start of the deliberations, but ultimately changed their minds after more than 8 hours of discussions with the other jurors. I was on a jury once, and it is the most enlightening view of civic duties I've ever experienced. Yeah. You understand the criminal justice system, but these are regular Philadelphians, right? And they take their duties so seriously. And the jurors listened to each other. They scoured the facts. They picked apart Dial's testimony, and ultimately they had questions about whether he in fact thought Irizarry had a gun. And so they came to the conclusion they wanted to be fair. And to me, it said a lot about our justice system, right? It said a lot about the care that our citizens have. And I think we need this type of insight. That's why I love this story so much. We need this type of insight and pull the cloak back and really see how the deliberations go. And talking with that foreman was great.
The jury system is not perfect, but it is in many ways miraculous.
It is.
When you see how it works from the inside. One more thing I'll add. When you hear the testimony from the foreman of the jury, you realize how important body camera footage was
this
case.
Yeah.
And, you know, a decade or two ago, we didn't have body camera footage from police officers. So reflect on that when you read this story. Okay, one more story, Cherry, and we're going to shift the tone here a little bit for story number three.
Yeah. Well, you know, Philadelphians love to grill, Avi.
Do they? More than other people?
We do it on stoops, sidewalks, street corners. I've seen a grill at all these places.
Okay.
But recently, when the aroma of charcoal grilled burgers wafted through Rittenhouse Square, somebody got big mad. They did. Philly
Mag. Dramatic setup. Oh, my God.
Philly Mag's Victor Fiorello did a story a few days ago about the outrage in Rittenhouse Square over a resident who took she basically took to the neighborhood Facebook page. She posted a photo of the incident. We posted it on our YouTube who complained to all who would look at the post about folks literally, you know, setting up a grill in Rittenhouse Square and grilling out. The reaction, of course, was mixed from the folks who commented. So Philly Mag, they did the labor of researching where you can actually grill in the city.
Where you're allowed to grill.
Where you're actually allowed, legally allowed.
Yeah.
And apparently Rittenhouse Square is not one of those places. So
not surprised.
So this person who was big mad in the Facebook group was actually right. You cannot camp in Rittenhouse Square. You cannot start fires using portable devices like grills in Rittenhouse Square. And there are apparently 20 designated Philly parks where you can grill, 159 designated areas in those parks, like Pennypack Park, right? There's a whole map that Philly Mag included in there. East and West Fairmount Park, to name a few. And they have grills, and those grills may be gross, so you might want to bring your own. But there are places.
Yeah.
So your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm curious for your thoughts. You're very passionate about this story. You were surprised you're not allowed to grill in Rittenhouse Square?
I didn't see people, like, actually, I've never seen anyone grilling, so I would think you couldn't, but I didn't think, you know, it would be that big of a deal if you did.
Well, I don't think it's a big deal.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have, like, snitched on the person. That I think, like, it's not, doesn't offend me, but of course, like, it's a very dense area. You definitely would not want people, lots of people, lighting fires.
Definitely not. I would have asked for a burger, though. I'd have been like, look, man, this is not legal, but if you give me that,
that's why you need to know the laws, because then you can blackmail someone.
With charcoal.
Yeah. Burgers. Say, look, I just looked up the city rules and regulations. You're not allowed to do this, but for a burger, I could overlook it. By the way, the map that Philly Mag put together was interesting in one regard. There are almost no parks where you're allowed to grill in Greater Center City at all. Almost all of the parks where you're allowed to grill are on the fringe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the whole center is just empty. There's no dots.
Exactly. It's a grill desert.
Yeah. I will say I did learn you're not supposed to grill on the rooftop deck. I did not know that, but lesson learned.
That seems like common sense. Let's grill some people about the budget bill coming up on Studio 2. We want to know how you feel about the so-called Big Beautiful Budget Bill Act. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. Stick with us. We'll be right back on WHYY.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York. That was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The bill is big, but beauty, well, that's in the eye of the beholder. House Republicans passed a sweeping budget proposal last week. It could become President Trump's signature legislative accomplishment, but first, it has to get through the Senate.
As written today, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act cuts Medicaid spending by adding a strict work requirement, directs more money to the military and immigration enforcement, and gives Americans a roughly $4 trillion tax cut.
Will it pass? Should it pass? And how would this bill change America? For those questions and more, let's bring in Connor Lamb, former Democratic congressman for the 17th District in Western Pennsylvania. He's also a lawyer at Klein & Spector. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And with us in studio is Guy Shiraki, senior fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation. Guy, always nice to have you on the program.
Great to be back.
And our question for you, our listeners this hour, is this. What do you think about President Trump's budget bill? What do you like or dislike? We want to hear your thoughts. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your comment in the live chat.
Connor Lamb, let me start with you. Imagine I'm just a average citizen on the street, and I'm asking you to describe what this bill does. Give me your elevator pitch, your condensed explanation of what this bill would do.
Well, it drives us deeper into debt as a nation by spending trillions of extra dollars that we're not going to bring in. And the reason for that is that they want to extend tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans that otherwise could have paid for a lot of things that we need. It also will take away health care and food assistance from millions and millions of Americans. We don't know exactly how many. So it's a strange worst of both worlds scenarios. I think a lot of people could understand if we were going to tighten up and limit benefits that the government would save money if we did that. But that's not what's happening. We're kicking people out of benefit programs, but then also losing money and going deeper into debt. It's really a bizarre thing that they've done.
Guy Shiraki, same question for you. How do you describe what this bill would do?
Two things. One is it's promises made, promises kept. The president, through the campaign and in the transition, working with Elon Musk and the folks at Doge, said that we need to change the way Washington spends our money, the money that comes out of our paychecks, the money that we send to Washington. So the first is it's a step towards that promises made, promises kept. And second, it's a beginning. It's a beginning. And it's interesting. I hear the congressman's comments. He points to two things. One is that we're spending too much, yet we're trying to cut back, and most of the complaints are about the cuts. And second, in terms of the tax cuts, there was a time when Congressman Lamb liked these tax cuts and voted for them. So I think we have to have an honest discussion. The nation is deeply in debt. We're spending money we don't have, largely having to borrow it from China. We're spending it on things that we don't need and in some cases are harmful. And at the same time, programs directed at people genuinely in need, that money may not be getting to them. This bill is a first step towards that, towards making sure we're not wasting money, not spending money we don't have, and getting money to programs that actually benefit real people.
A first step toward what, though? Let me just follow up on that. Like, you think there's going to be another bill behind this that actually reduces the federal deficit? Like, what's the indication that that would be coming based on Trump's prior actions?
Sure. So Congress, a number of members of Congress have talked about new legislation coming next week that begin to codify some of the things that were identified through the DOGE process, things that where we were spending money on things that are wasteful or fraudulent or actually harmful to Americans or America. So that's the second part of it. Look, regardless of when this bill gets passed, I assume Congress has other things to do. I hope they do. There are things that need to be done to reform the way we spend our dollars, the way we send foreign aid, the way we fund our military, the way we take care of those in need. So this is a first step. So I see this as an important kickstart, but clearly there'll be more legislation coming down the road. And we have to have an honest discussion about how we're using the dollars. Prior to COVID, the federal budget was not quite $4 billion. It's now going to break $7 trillion. We've doubled spending. COVID's over. The baseline for spending—
I think it's $4 trillion to $7
trillion.
$4 trillion,
yeah,
correct. Just to clarify.
Because that would be really big.
Yeah, that would be a big jump.
But we have to really begin to get back to the way spending should have been in 2020. The spending should be back around $4 or $5 trillion, not $7 trillion. And if every time we talk about reducing funding in foreign aid or to some nonprofit or to some organization like Harvard, if every time we attempt to cut money, they're screaming, we're never going to have an honest discussion about how that money should be spent.
And quick follow-up to you before I play a clip, because I got to ask you this. Is this the time to really go deeper, giving deeper tax cuts, Guy? If we do have this deficit that you just said grew since COVID, why give even deeper tax cuts?
One, because if we don't renew the Trump tax cuts, it would be a tax increase of about $2,000 on the average family in America. So one, we have to keep the tax cuts of 2020 in place. Otherwise, it's a tax increase. And secondly, every single tax cut going back to President John Kennedy has resulted in the federal government's revenue growing. I have no doubt that keeping these cuts in place not only keeps money in the pockets of everyday families, but next year the federal government will take in more money than it did the year before, just as it's done almost every single year.
And I'm teeing this up because I want to play this clip and then give Connor a chance to respond, because Elon Musk was on CBS Sunday, and he said he was actually disappointed by the big, beautiful bill passed by Republicans in the House last week. Take a listen to what he had to say.
So, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing. I think a bill can be big, or it can be beautiful. But I don't know if it could be both. My personal opinion.
And Connor, I want to give you a chance to weigh in here, because first of all, Guy Shiraki said a lot. Is Elon Musk right in this particular situation?
Well, I think the only thing he's right about is that this bill definitely adds trillions of dollars with a T to the debt and deficit. So that's why I just think it's so strange, the argument that people like Guy are adopting, that we have to get federal spending under control, so therefore we'll run up the debt and deficit even worse. Those two things are basically opposites. You could have done that. You could have contributed to reducing the debt or deficit if you were just willing to bring in some revenue from people that earn like in the millions and billions of dollars. you did some common sense things on corporate taxes, or even without even changing the tax code at all, giving the IRS the tools that they need to do their job. But instead, Trump is very eager to pardon people who are tax cheats and make the IRS's job harder rather than easier. You know, I just think that he has promised too many different things to too many different people. The idea that Doge is going to somehow and come in and save the day is just a joke. I mean, Elon Musk came in saying that they were going to cut $2 trillion through Doge. They now only claim to have done $175 billion. And even that is a very specious claim if you've ever looked at their website and see how difficult it is to follow anything. So, you know, and I don't want it to be lost, the human toll of all of this, you know, when they're not just preserving the tax cuts, which again, they could preserve the tax cuts for middle-class people, which is what many of us have supported. They're preserving it for the wealthy and at the same time taking things away from the bottom 10% of our society. It's a direct transfer of the money that we are now using for people's healthcare and food benefits to be used instead to make taxes cheaper for people that don't need that kind of relief. That's not what Trump campaigned on. That's not promises made, promises kept. Trump was the guy in the McDonald's drive-through window talking about being for average people. That's not what average people are clamoring for. So he's going to have himself in some political trouble here pretty soon.
And Rebecca on YouTube says only certain Americans get the tax breaks, the big brutal bill. But before I get this back to Guy Shiraki, Connor Lamb, let me just ask you about this idea that we've heard a lot from, especially budget hawks in the Republican Party. The federal government was about yay big pre-COVID. Its spending grew a lot. We have to get it back to that pre-COVID level as we transition back to a more normal economy and a more normal size of federal government. Do you agree in principle with that? And if so, like, where would the cuts come from in a way that you believe would be fair to the average American?
I don't think that's really how you think about it. I think what we should be talking about is whatever the government is spending in a given year, is it doing so effectively? Is it having the result that people think it should have? Now, I would argue that a lot of the things that we did during COVID were actually quite effective because they were designed to vaccinate people, save their lives, get them adequate medical care. We kept, I don't know how many millions of Americans from being evicted from their houses. The child tax credit reduced poverty in this country by half. We reduced child poverty by half in a single year with just one of those measures. And by the way, in the big signature Biden bill that is sort of the equivalent to this one Trump is doing, which is called the Inflation Reduction Act, we reduced the deficit with that bill by raising taxes. We had a corporate global minimum tax of 15%. We gave the IRS additional resources, and we had a tax on stock buybacks, all of which can, and we allowed Medicare to bargain for the price of drugs, which reduced what they were spending. So it is possible to do like big and important things while also contributing to debt reduction if you're willing to just charge the wealthiest people in our society for the privilege of being a citizen here, which I think a lot of people agree with.
And let me get your reaction to that, Guy Shiraki, as I read in another comment. And this is an interesting one from David on YouTube. I wish that traditional deficit hawk Republicans would start a new party so we can refer to what we have now as the MAGA party, which is very different from traditional Republicans. Although traditional Republicans would not be in favor, I would imagine, of more taxes on corporations, on earners, really anywhere across the spectrum. So, Guy Shiraki, if this is the new populist Republican Party, why not raise some taxes on wealthier Americans or restore old tax rates on wealthier Americans to pay for some of the other tax breaks and the other investments that Trump wants to make?
Because we have a spending problem, not a revenue problem. The federal government takes in more than enough money. We spend more than we take in. They spend more than we take in. Congress and the president of both parties have spent exponentially more dollars than we bring in. We should stop finding ways to take money out of the economy, to take money out of the pockets of small businesses, to take money out of the pockets of everyday families, to send it to Washington. We have to find ways to keep more money in the economy, more money in people's pockets, more money in businesses to create jobs and create growth, and stop looking at ways to send more. What I think is interesting is through this whole debate, whether it's been today with Congressman Lamb or with others, through the DOGE process, there has not been one program that any Democratic member of Congress or any Democratic spokesperson has come forward and say, this program could be cut. This program could be eliminated. We don't need to do this anymore. We spent exponentially more dollars for the COVID emergency. It's over. Right. It's been over for years. We need to get back on a path. And here, when we begin to talk about reducing some spending, again, if we want to have a debate about how to cut it, I wish this did more. I think many Republicans wish it did more. This is the best
more
bill.
More in what area, just specifically? Yeah.
Across the board. Yeah. Across the board. But we spent too much. We spent too much money. And look, on the whole issue, again, of Medicare, I want money to go to people in need. 30-year-old single men who are able-bodied should have to work. Some of them may find gainful employment and the problem is solved. Some of whom are getting a benefit without having to work or contribute. A generation ago, that was something that everybody agreed to. President Clinton signed bills to that effect with fanfare. That was something that Republicans and Democrats agreed to a generation ago. The suggestion now that an able-bodied single person should find work or volunteer or otherwise not get benefits is somehow viewed as draconian or unfair when it's something that 8 out of 10 Americans agreed to a generation ago. How can we ever begin to discuss reducing spending on social programs, on grants, on aid, on foreign aid, if every time we attempt to reduce a dollar, they're screaming and wailing about how is this is going to be a dramatic. Senator Schumer said that children will starve if this budget is put into effect. I defy him to prove that. We're going to spend $7 trillion. How is any child in America going to starve? If that happens, it's not because of a lack of money. It's because some government program or some agency we hired failed to do their job. It's not a revenue problem. It's a spending problem.
I want to ask you this follow-up, Guy, because one of the things that President Trump said was don't F with Medicaid. He said that. And this big, beautiful bill passed by Republicans in the House, by one vote, would cut hundreds of billions from Medicaid. It would put in all sorts of requirements. At the same time, DOGE has cut workers from the federal government. And I mean, a lot of people, many Democrats, all the Democrats are taking issue with this because it's going to muck up the system. And instead of sort of, you know, just touching the people you talk about who may be abusing the system, that it could affect people who actually needed. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think we're talking about Medicare, not Medicaid.
Medicaid, yeah.
Right. So again, but if we can't have the conversation, if every time we say we should reduce spending or that some people taking money from a program aren't eligible for it, if it get reduced to some child's going to starve, how did we get there? If saying that able-bodied single people ought to find employment or find volunteer work to contribute in order to receive a benefit, and that as a result, some will find jobs and not need it, or some will find other ways to contribute. How does that get down to a 3-year-old child starves? How does a single person getting a benefit?
That's not really answering the question, though, Guy. I mean, the question is, the president said, don't F with, right. Don't, and this is sort of really going at the heart of something that many Americans in the districts that voted for Trump do care about.
Right. And what it'll actually do. Well, first of all, with all due respect to the president, he's the president. He gets an oversized voice. He doesn't get the only voice. Members of Congress get input, too. And again, we have to have this debate. I mean, is it good when Donald Trump's a dictator or bad? He made an opinion known. He has to compromise, just like to get the bill passed through the House, that they compromise. Again, I think all of us want to make sure that people genuinely in need, people that are truly in poverty, people with genuine disabilities, the hurricane victims in North Carolina, all Americans understand the social compact of helping those people. What we don't understand is sending money around the world to agencies that don't really help our national interest, or spending money on an agency on a Medicare program that is supposed to help those in need that is helping able-bodied people. That's unfair to taxpayers. We are borrowing money from the Chinese to pay for a government we can't sustain. Let's get money where it belongs. And if every time we talk about reducing it slowing the growth,
right,
if there's wailing and we talk about starving children, we can't have an honest discussion.
Let's get some comments in now from our listeners. Lucy in Allentown says, I think I've never been more terrified of our federal government. There's nothing in this bill that should be passed. Everything seems to gut what I believe the federal government should be doing. Jeff asks, can your guests explain what part of the bill benefits the wealthy with a tax cut? So I'll put that to you, Connor Lamb. the Democrat argument here is that this is a massive wealth transfer from the poorest to the richest. Explain how, if it's largely keeping in place some tax cuts that had already been passed.
Sure. And I would just point out, I'm not wailing or screaming. I'm just trying to point out the logical results that follow from the bill like this as it's written. So what it does for the wealthy, the one new provision is that it expands the carve out for very wealthy people's estates or inheritances. So now it goes all the way up to $30 million. If you die and your estate is worth $29 million, you're not going to pay a penny of tax to the government when you pass that on to your heirs. Now, I think there are a lot of people who think there's some part of your inheritance that should not be taxed because you spent your life paying taxes on it and working for it, and et cetera. But America also has always been a country where the idea was each generation is supposed to make it for themselves. So, you know, I just don't know that many people who are dying with $29 million in wealth and really needed that tax advantage, but that was something that Trump gave them. The thing it does on taxes more broadly is it keeps in place the tax cuts that Trump put into place in 2017. Otherwise, they would have expired. The Democratic proposal was, let's let them expire for the wealthy. We'll keep them in place for the middle class, for the working classes, for all the people for whom money is tight. But for the wealthy, let's let the taxes go back up a little bit because we do have this big debt and deficit problem. You know, if our deficit was at zero and we didn't have much of a national debt, we might not need to be talking about taxing the wealthy, but we have this huge hole that has been contributed to by Democrats and Republicans alike, and we have to do something about it. So you can do what Guy is saying, which is just make an ideological commitment that we're going to cut government spending no matter what, and we're going to cut it over several years to some level. I don't know what level he thinks is appropriate or what it's based on, but it's just an ideological commitment to cutting spending. I think from my side, we look at it as, what needs are out there and what problems are we solving? So the idea that Medicaid is going to so-called able-bodied people who don't want to work, there's a logical disconnect, right? I mean, if we're talking about a cash assistance program where people are sitting around not working and getting cash, you could see why that might be a problem. We're talking about health insurance. Like, I don't really know anyone that sits around and doesn't do anything all day because they just love it when they get sick and go to the doctor and the government pays for that instead of them. The reason that this all got started is because people who are working, who are already earning money, are not earning enough to afford what healthcare really costs. Like, healthcare costs in this country just go up and up and up, and it's a huge problem. And so the Obamacare marketplaces and the expansion of Medicaid was supposed to help these people who really are out there working just be able to afford healthcare. And that's what it really is doing.
As we come to a break, Guy, let me steer that to you. I think what Connor Lamb is saying is that it's a red herring to say that there are people not working just so that they can get, you know, health insurance from the government. Do you believe there's evidence that that is what's happening and that fixing that would go a significant way toward, closing that deficit?
I think it's a piece of the puzzle. Again, we should help people genuinely in need. We should not be helping people genuinely not in need. And if research has been done.
But I think what he's saying is some people in that bracket are genuinely in need. That's sure. Why they're getting the Medicaid.
Right. So that if right now we're spending money on 100 people and if 10 of them don't need it, why should we spend it? So if you reduce the part for the 10% or the 4% that don't need it, and then you complain that there's been a cut to the program, there's a cut to the program because you're removing the people who weren't supposed to get it in the first place. I'm for, everyone is for, people genuinely in need of the assistance. What we're opposed to is it being abused. Again, he's for cuts. Democrats are for cuts until you try to identify some area to cuts, and then we come back to revenue. I would, again, politely remind the congressman that he voted for these tax cuts in 2018, and now he's suggesting that his vote was a mistake.
Well, we'll give Connor Lamb a chance to respond to that
on
the other side of this break, but we do have one coming up. We can't stop time. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. We're talking about the big, beautiful bill act. What do you think about it? What do you like or dislike? Give us a call, 888-477-9499.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking about President Trump's budget bill that passed the House and is now in the U.S. Senate. With us this hour to discuss the local reactions are Connor Lamb, Democrat and former U.S. representative, now a lawyer at Klein and Spector. We also have Guy Shiraki, a Republican and senior fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation.
And of course, we want to hear from you, as always. What do you think about President Trump's budget bill? What do you like or dislike about it? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, how you doing? Drop a comment right there in the chat.
And so before the break, Connor, Guy said something about you having liked the tax cuts previously when you were in office. Want to give you an opportunity to respond.
Oh, sure. Well, I wasn't in Congress when these tax cuts were initially passed by President Trump. I think what Guy's probably referring to is the following year, right before the election, they do these gotcha votes on things like this. You know, should we keep the tax cuts or shouldn't we, so that they can run a commercial if you say that we shouldn't. I liked the tax cuts for the working class and the middle class, and the bill we were presented with was be either for all of it or against all of it. So I said, sure, let's keep them for now. The budgetary picture was pretty different back then, as were interest rates. It was all before COVID. And like I said, it also wasn't really the original bill itself, which I wasn't there for.
Yeah. And so now I want to tee up a conversation about the politics of all of this. And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke on social media last week after the House Republicans passed President Trump's big, beautiful bill. And here's what he had to say.
It is no wonder that Republicans had to pass their big, beautiful bill in the dark of night. It ain't beautiful. It is ugly. This is not what America wants. Democrats will fight it tooth and nail.
And so, Connor, I want you to start this part of the conversation and talk about, is this an opening for Democrats? How will they use this big, beautiful bill, you know, this year and in the upcoming midterms, if it is able to pass?
Well, I bet that one thing that Guy and I probably agree on is the hysterical nature of a lot of communications coming out of Washington is, I think, getting old for a lot of people. So I don't think the path for Democrats is to, you know, almost cheerlead this kind of thing or, you know, talk about starvation or whatever the case. I think it's enough to just be honest and accurate about what the consequences of this bill really are. So, you know, in our state of Pennsylvania, there's a list of a dozen or so rural hospitals and healthcare centers that could either close entirely or lose crucial services like the ability to deliver a baby once these Medicaid cuts go into effect. Because again, we're not just talking, like in Guy's example, of one person out of 10 beneficiaries that's getting the benefits that they shouldn't. The Republicans have said this is going to be $800 billion less Medicaid spending. It's an enormous substantive cut. And so not only are people going to lose their coverage, but even if you're not on Medicaid, the healthcare center closest to you might close because of this. SNAP is another great example. It's used by a lot of seniors that are working and just trying to make ends meet and need a little bit of help. These kind of things are going to hit people in the gut because it really wasn't who Trump said he was going to be. And I think if we can just present that in a factual and clear way for people, that the choice is, you know, do you want to keep these programs that really do help make life affordable for the average person? Or do you want to spend, you know, the government's money on making life even easier for wealthy people? That's going to be the campaign issue in 2026.
And Guy, how do Republicans counter that? And I'll also throw in here, because Connor Lamb talked about local impact, also these clean energy tax breaks. You can pull up a map of where they were being used to invest. And a lot of that is in rural communities across Pennsylvania. You know, a school in Indiana County, for instance, or a senior center in Cambria County. These are not real examples, by the way, but they're like that. They're out there, and I could give you some real ones in a moment. But Guy, what's the counter message to that, especially in communities where there is ground level impact on these programs, or in this, the other case, the clean energy tax breaks?
I think the message and the takeaway is pretty straightforward, is that Washington's broken. We're spending too much money. They're spending too much of our money. And most of us don't think that they're using the money wisely. And in some cases, we think the money's being abused or wasted. And the takeaway is that most Democrats seem uninterested in participating in how to solve it. We are now into the fifth month of the Trump presidency on the heels of a bad economy with trillions of dollars in debt. We're trying to turn things around, and almost no Democrat seems willing to want to sit down and say, here's where we can cut, here's where we can eliminate, or here's where we can fix things. That's the problem. I think if we continue on that path nationally, not only will things be more divisive, I think the Democrats are playing a risk. And as somebody who would like the problem solved, I would prefer these were solved in a bipartisan, overwhelmingly supported way, the way that President Clinton was able to do things, the way that President Reagan was able to do things. But if every time we talk about a reduction, we have these fights and we talk about starvation and children in need and all this stuff. So the politics of it is this. The Republicans have acknowledged what the voters believe. That is, Washington is broken. The Democrats seem unwilling to participate in that debate. Chuck Schumer is the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. And every time we talk about restructuring government or how to use dollars wisely or how to stop wasting money overseas, we get these horrific speeches. The Democratic Party has to decide, do they want to participate in the debate or not?
Well, let me flip that real quick and just say, you know, they might, Chuck Schumer, if he was here, might say, every time we talk about restructuring the tax system, the tax incentives, the way corporations or the wealthy are taxed, there is the same reaction on the Republican side. They're not willing to put some more money in the coffers so we can get this thing in balance.
The way to put more money in the coffers is to grow the economy. It is to stop looking at ways to tax people and find new ways to tax people. We do not have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. If the economy is growing, revenue will go up. If the economy is vibrant, if we are creating jobs, if people's wages are going up, if their savings are going up, more revenue comes in. The way to grow the government to the extent we need to, which is really not the biggest problem, but the way to do it is through economic growth and to stop looking at ways to tax people. Without employers, we don't have employees. We should stop looking at ways to punish people who are successful. And we have to begin to have real cuts and not Washington cuts, not Washington cuts where we typically grow things at 10%. Instead, we grow them at 5% and call it a 50%
cut. No tax increase even on the wealthy. You think
no tax increase. We don't need more money. The federal government will take in more money this year than it did last year. We need to find a way to slow the spending and stop wasting the spending. And if you want to come to energy, we're sitting in the midst of a state that has more energy than Saudi Arabia. Let's get our natural gas out of the ground, yeah. Lower the cost of living in Pennsylvania and create thousands of jobs.
And I want to bring in, we have a bunch of callers, people, you sparked something, Guy. And so we want to bring in Kate from New Jersey, who's on the line. Kate, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. I laughed out loud at Guy's absurd comment a little while ago that only people, quote, only people who really need the money should get it. I would like to remind Guy that a lot of us don't have any money and that the billionaires are the people, the very people who do not need the money. Wake up, mister. Thank you.
That is Kate from New Jersey.
Yeah,
I want to bring in another caller. We have Gary from Mount Airy on the line. Gary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
It's a comment, and that is that the big elephant in the room that nobody ever talks about, including NPR, is that it's the military-industrial complex and how we spend half our budget on the defense budget. That's where all the waste, the fraud, and abuse is going. We're spending now $95 billion per year on the modernization of our nuclear weapons. That's $1 trillion over the next 10 years just on that ridiculous weapon system. And yet both parties, 90% of Democrats vote for the grotesque military budget, 100% of Republicans. They're both bought off. Nothing will change until we stop voting for people that are taking money from the military-industrial complex and are afraid to stand up against it.
Thank you so much. That's Gary from Mount Airy. Also, Judy says maybe not spend so much on military. Guy, your comments on that, because there's been an increased military budget. And people have said, and Trump has admitted that there has been waste in military spending. Why not crack down on that versus some of the poorest Americans?
Sure. Well, first, I'm glad I gave somebody in New Jersey a laugh, if nothing else. I think we should. I think DOGE should go to the military. I think to the men and women who are putting their lives on the line around the world to defend us, their equipment should work and not $1 should be wasted. I think we have a moral obligation both to the carpenter in Downingtown who's paying taxes and to the service member who's stationed in Japan that we not waste $1. So I think DOGE should go to the Pentagon and make sure. And if we're lining the pockets of lobbyists, if we're lining the pockets of dictators, if we're wasting money, go to it. I don't think there's one serious public official who would be opposed to that. At the same time, things cost money. Ships cost money. Tanks cost money. Drones cost money. The men and women in service deserve an honorable pay. So let's get rid of it. I'm all for it. I'm all for cutting the waste, fraud, and abuse in every single agency. The Pentagon is no different than the Department of Education, no different than the Department of Labor. Let's make sure not one dime should come out of anybody's paycheck that's being wasted or abused. I'm all for it.
Connor Lamb, you were in the service, so let me get your take on that. You know, lots of times Democrats are opposed to cuts of any stripe when it comes to the social safety net. But what about spending on the military? Is that an area where we talk about reduced government spending that the government could take some action?
The challenge with the military discussion right now is that the mission of our military has changed pretty dramatically in very recent history. So for a lot of my adult life, it was these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the overall war against terrorism. And that required, you know, certain types of weapons and troop deployments and all the rest. And sort of very recently, all of that has shifted. We're worrying again about a great power war with China or Russia or a combination of them and Iran. And we have to make a lot of new investments. You have the rise of AI at the same time, very much affecting drones and new styles of warfare. And so I think I would agree with everything Guy said about how every dollar has to be accounted for and nothing wasted. But we're probably at a moment where the challenges of the present day are going to require us to make some new investments in things we don't already have to be ready if that horrible moment comes when, you know, China invades Taiwan or whatever the crisis is. I also just wanted to quickly, if I could, address the previous caller's question from New Jersey who said, you know, a lot of us don't have money. I think that's one of the big differences between how I'm coming at this and maybe how someone like Guy is that, when you're in office and you're talking to constituents, you find out that their overall concern, their number one concern, is never in the abstract, what is the size of the government? Their concerns are very concrete. They are, what can I afford today? And there is a big affordability crisis in America on just really basic things, whether it's healthcare or school or the cost of your first home or whatever the case. And so a lot of these things that we are advocating for when it comes to Medicaid or food assistance are things that are just supposed to help the average person just a little bit, maybe have a little bit more breathing room in their family budget. And if it requires a little bit more government spending, then it's actually responding to the real needs of the people that we represent. And you can pay that by the people who've gained so much at the top of the economy.
And I want to bring in another caller. We can squeeze one in. Danielle from Delaware County is on the line. Danielle, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my name's Danielle, and I live in Delaware County, where another hospital, Crozier, has just closed, which is a massive concern for our entire community. And I also wanted to say I am also a Medicaid recipient. I grew up working since I was 16 years old. I had the misfortune of getting diagnosed with cancer, like so many people, was on a health care plan, and after my diagnosis got kicked off and had to scramble. I'd never been on Medicaid or any kind of aid, and oncology social workers helped me to do that. And I'd like to let people know it's also a freaking full-time job. It's literally what I do to make appointments to this day. I've had that for pay before, but I am concerned because our budget reflects our priorities, and what is not reflected is everything we pretend we care about. We don't care about our children. Otherwise, we would, you know, take care of the basic needs, which all human beings have: food, shelter, clothing, and an actual really quality education about not just our country, but the global environment we live in. There are so many cultures now. We're obviously all connected. So the pretense that because someone doesn't know someone who's starving, come on over, I'll help you out with that, or doesn't have enough, or people are lazy.
Yeah.
We need to reflect what we pretend we care about
in this country.
Thank you so much for sharing that personal mm-hmm. testimony, Danielle from Delaware County. Real mm-hmm. quick response, Guy. I think embedded in that was the idea that an overwhelming round of paperwork and requirements bogs the system down, mm-hmm. and it almost traps the recipients in this cycle of needing it because they commit so much time just to getting the benefits.
Right, which is why everybody that has to come in contact with the federal government, either as a taxpayer or somebody that's involved in a program, knows it's broken. It's too big, it's too bloated, it's bureaucratic. And to Connor's point, it doesn't work, right? You talk about real people. So first for Danielle, I mean, there's nobody that thinks she shouldn't get help. And there's nobody that's talking about cutting off her aid. And anyone suggesting to her in a TV ad or a flyer or rhetoric on YouTube that she's going to be hurt is lying to her. It is in no one's interest. It is in no one's compassion, common sense, or pocketbook to hurt her. What we want to do is make sure the money gets to her and there's enough money to her and that none of it's being abused. And as to the bureaucracy and the insanity of the paperwork, that's part of what DOGE is supposed to help us do. But again, if we talk about paperwork being reduced or the size of an agency being reduced, and all we do is talk about why that's a bad idea, we never get it. We should give her not only quality health care, but we should give her hours of her life back by fixing a broken system.
Is it the cart coming before the horse then? Why not fix the efficiency before you start mucking it up with more red tape, Guy? And we have to wrap up.
Right. We're going to get rid of the red tape. And the way to do it is not by feeding it more dollars. It's by reducing the dollars, but making sure the dollars go where they're needed.
I wish we had more time, but we don't. I will just acknowledge Lisa Kitt and others who wanted us to talk about this contempt clause around courts in the budget bill. Hopefully we'll get to that another day. But Connor Lamb, a former Democratic congressman for the 17th District in Western Pennsylvania, thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And Guy Shiraki, Senior Fellow at the Commonwealth Foundation. Always a pleasure to have you here in our Philadelphia studios.
Thanks. Enjoy being here.
Yes, and thanks to all the folks on YouTube and who emailed and commented online and called in. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Diana Martinez. And Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2, here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt, neither big nor beautiful, but I do thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.